If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. The guest on today's episode is Valerie Hansen, Professor of History at Yale and the author of The Year 1000, When Explorers Connected the World and Globalization Began. World History's editor Matt Elton spoke to Valerie about why it was 1000 AD rather than 1492 that saw people take the first meaningful step towards the interconnected world we know today, and why that story has often been overlooked.
What do you think is the established historical view of the start of globalization?
I don't think there's a single historiographical view of when globalization began. I think there are probably two dominant paradigms. One of them would locate globalization in the late 1970s, and the other one would put it earlier, probably around 1500.
Okay.
And the difference would just have to do with, I think everyone would acknowledge that the 1970s were the full flowering of globalization, especially with outsourcing of manufacturing and the ease of travel as maybe the two main things you could point to. The 1500 argument would be to say that the Columbus and Da Gama and Magellan tied together the world in a way that hadn't occurred before. And if I could just say, like, what I am trying to do in this book is grant that, yes, something did happen in 1500, but something very important happened in the year 1000 that made the changes of 1500 possible.
So your book focuses obviously on the year 1000. Why do you think that that year's importance hasn't been highlighted sufficiently elsewhere before?
I think it has to do basically with a shift away from Eurocentric narrative. So if you focus your gaze only on the North or the Mid-Atlantic, let's just say the Mid-Atlantic, then of course you will say 1492 is the beginning of contact, Europe's contacts with other parts of the world. But if you look globally around the world, you'll see that those contacts started much earlier, in fact, around the year 1000.
And this is obviously an impossibly broad question in a sense, but what was the world like in the year 1000? If we were to travel back from the 21st century to the year 1000, what would we see at different points in the world?
Well, I think the main difference that everyone would notice immediately is the lack of electricity or steam power or fossil fuels, right? This is the world in the year 1000 is a world where people are walking or sailing or rowing to get around. Of course, there's no communication, telephones or anything like that. There's no electricity-run factories. There is a lot of mass manufacturing. I think much more than we imagine today is possible. There were factories capable of producing in China, the world's leading manufacturer then, factories capable of producing several thousand ceramic pots in a single firing. But it was done with wood, or sometimes coal or coke, the fuel of for the kilns. And then there's a large labor force. They're just not sitting in a room powered by electric light. They're still functioning with natural light. I also think it's a world that is not capitalist in any sense that we understand it today. Mm. That they're, they're the richest people are merchants and they're making things and selling things, but there's no stock market any place in the world yet.
Do we have a sense of what the world population was in 1000 AD?
It's about 250 million.
Okay.
And China's population is probably around 100 million. So that's 40% of the world's population then. And China's proportion of the world population is somewhere between a quarter and two-fifths, a quarter, a third, two-fifths of the world's population over all time.
Are there any other ways in which the world of 1000 is more similar to the world of today that we might expect?
Well, I think the first thing is that it was a world with multiple power centers. So the world after 1500, really Europe is the most powerful nation, and the most of the exploration that's going on is coming out of, Europe, is being done by European explorers. So whereas in the year 1000, China's an important power, the Islamic world is an important power. To tell the truth, Europe is still very far behind the Islamic world and China. European historians see a huge increase in Europe's economic power and strength, starting really with the Crusades around 1100, and then accelerating in 1200 and 1300. There's the different parts of the people living in the different regions of the world are much more evenly balanced. So in that sense, it's much more like our world today. And then a major similarity, and this would be true, I think, of any period in the past, although we tend to forget this, that the people are themselves just this, like people like us, and they react in the same way, and they are frightened by new things, or some people are curious about new opportunities. And that's what makes it so interesting, I think, to look at this world and imagine ourselves facing the decisions that people were facing then and thinking about how we might do what they decided to do.
What were the first sparks of globalization that you identified as happening in 1000 AD?
Well, I think the absolute first one and also the one that we can firmly date to the year 1000 is the crossing of the North Atlantic by the Vikings, who are starting from modern Scandinavia and particularly Denmark, and then moving to Iceland, and then from Iceland to Greenland, and then from Greenland to what is now Canada, north. It's funny when we say northeastern North America. So the maritime provinces of Quebec, and then Newfoundland and Labrador.
Mm. How can we find out about their voyages?
There's two two kinds of sources. One source that is oral narratives that were written down in Icelandic in about the 12 and 1300s. And these are accounts that families passed down from one generation to the next about their ancestors' accomplishments. And there's a, I think the many historians are skeptical about how accurate those accounts are. I'm one of the people who thinks that they have more information about these voyages than I would say the pure literary view would be that they are entirely fictitious and have no link to actual historic events. But the we know that they have a link to actual historic events because the in the 1960s, two Norwegian archaeologists, well, actually a diplomat and his archaeologist wife, the Ingstads, used the narratives to find, to look for the places where the Vikings had gone. And they found an archaeological site at a Canadian town. It's on the northern tip of the island of Newfoundland called, and the site is called Lanshaw Meadows. And that is a, there's no, indisputably, that is an archaeological site testifying to the Norse crossings of the North Atlantic. So that, I think, is the moment that the book starts with and that we can look at and say is the beginning of this earlier wave of globalization. Then we can look around the world and see that in different places, but in many different places that people are building, well, are moving to new places. I think this is linked to that question about population that maybe when the world reaches, maybe I shouldn't say maybe, we'll just say when the world reaches a population of 250 million, that seems to be a tipping point and people start to go to new places. There's no new technology. There's no technological breakthroughs. But and when the Vikings cross the Atlantic, they're crossing it in sailboats that also have oars. So it's very and there's no evidence that they used any navigational instruments. That this is just they're sailing by with a sense of by paying attention to the stars and the tides and having a sense that like when they see birds that they'll be getting near to an island and or a settlement, some kind of human settlement. So that anyway, so all around the world, so it's the Vikings are crossing the North Atlantic. There are sailors, the ancestors of the modern residents of Malaysia who speak a Polynesian language, a language related to Polynesian, so they're called the Malayo-Polynesians. They cross the Pacific. We have Chinese navigators going into the Indian Ocean. So this is happening all around the world.
Rather than being a technologically driven breakthrough, can we see this as being a breakthrough driven by agriculture?
It's definitely, agriculture plays a role because it contributes to the rise in population. Right, that because you have in the main agricultural centers of Afro-Eurasia, oh, and we know a little bit about the Maya, but so in Western Europe, in England and France, in China, especially southern China, in the Islamic world, so the area around the area of modern Iraq, we have a lot of agricultural innovation occurring, and we know that productivity is going up. And that productivity frees some people from having to work the land. And the same is probably true in the Maya heartland in Mexico, in the in the Maya heartland in Mexico. So that increase in population, I think, certainly contributes to the globalization. But I think the sea journey part of it is key to seeing the integration of different regions. There's also a lot of overland travel. There are new routes opening up across Afro-Eurasia, but also that's one of the things that's very interesting about the Americas. We have no written documents from the Maya from the year 1000. The last Maya inscriptions are from around 900. But the we know archaeologically, we can see archaeologically evidence of contact between the Maya. So in the year 1000, they're biggest city is on the Yucatan Peninsula, contact between them and the American, what we call the Southwest, so the states of Utah and Arizona, Colorado. And there is a trade in chocolate. The Maya have figured out how to process cacao beans, and they're drinking unsweetened chocolate, and they drink it as a stimulant. And so there's exporting that to this region of New Mexico and Utah. And then the people there are exporting turquoise in the sending turquoise in the opposite direction to the Maya. That's a place where archaeology can help us reconstruct those routes, and we can see new trade routes that we may not be able, we don't have written evidence for the Americas about, but by looking at the presence of commodities from one place that are indigenous to another, we can be quite confident that trade is taking place.
You write that it's important to state that the Norse didn't start trade in the Americas. What they did was connect trade networks that had already begun there with a wider kind of global network.
Well, it's funny. What I actually said was that that's true of the Spanish.
Okay.
I mean, you know, with Christopher Columbus. So, because when the Norse come, they are there for just about 10 years, and there's very little evidence. In the Vinland sagas, they describe encounters between the indigenous peoples and the Norse and the kind of trading that's taking place. In one of the accounts, the Norse are trading red cloth. In another account, they're trading milk and maybe some kind of cheese for the furs. That's the product that the indigenous peoples present to the Norse. But in the year 1000, we can see all across North America, and then some of it connecting to the Andean region in South America, these trade routes. And then what's interesting is Columbus, when Columbus arrives in the Caribbean, his son is with him, his illegitimate son, and the son has left us a description of a canoe, a Maya canoe, that is a giant trade canoe. It's supposed to be as big as a Venetian galley. And so, of course, people debate how big that is. But, you know, it could be, let me think in meters, 30 meters long, maybe. And it is loaded with trade goods that are circulating all between Mexico and then the islands of the Caribbean. And so that pre-existing set of trade networks is what the Spanish plug into in the Americas. And then a similar pre-existing trade network has taken shape in Africa, and that's what the Portuguese manage to plug into when they land on the West African coast.
What was the situation in Africa?
Again, starting around the year 1000, and it's just funny in so many parts of the world that when you look at what's going on, so many events seem to cluster around the year 1000. But we have a detailed account of different towns in Africa along trade routes written in Arabic by a scholar named Al-Bakri, who's actually living in Spain, in Cordoba. He doesn't go to Africa, but he writes about Africa, and he writes about the conversion of local rulers to Islam. He also talks about the trade that's taking place, and there's a key trade. It's a triangle trade that, starting on the Mediterranean ports of North Africa, traders are bringing cloth and some European-like beads. We would say manufactured goods, except they weren't made in factories. They're handicrafts. And those goods are then the Africans are at the at those ports on the North African coast are trading the main commodities that are leaving Africa. So that's gold and also some slaves. So then the triangle trade is that those handicraft goods from Europe are carried overland to the salt mines in the Sahara, and then they're traded for salt, and then the caravans carry the salt farther south, where they trade the salt for gold and slaves, and then they return trip back up to those Mediterranean ports. So Africa is definitely connected by trade to the Mediterranean, and then also to the Islamic world, which is to the east of Africa. And so because of those contacts, we have a written record that we can work with. So we have more information about what's going on in Africa than we do in the Americas.
You mentioned Islam there. What role did that religion and Christianity play in driving this change?
In the year 1000, it's the what we now call the world religions. A lot of them get their start, gain traction in the year 1000. So it's Islam, Christianity. There's no Protestantism yet, right? The Reformation hasn't happened, but there's the Roman Christianity, and then Eastern Orthodoxy. There's also Hinduism and Buddhism, and all of these religions have an appeal to the rulers of smaller countries that are trying to figure out how to become more powerful. And so these different rulers are, most of them have gained power by the usual means, killing their rivals, winning a few battles, and they most of their people are worshiping local deities, and they see that they have, there are rulers they hear about. That's one of the things, the circulation of information increases around the year 1000, and they hear about powerful rulers, and then they make a decision about which religion to adopt, which larger religion to adopt, so that they can ally with those rulers and enhance their own power. And the best example of that is a Russian ruler. Well, he's the ruler of the Rus, so it's in the region of modern Russia. The word Russia comes from Rus, and the prince is named Vladimir. And in 985, his people, just as I was saying, that they often are, these new rulers are living in societies where people are worshiping local deities. And Vladimir takes power in a series of complicated events, including killing two half-brothers. And then he puts up shrines to these local deities. But then I think he realizes that he needs something more as a glue to hold his people together. And he's unusual because he sends out fact-finding missions to his neighbors to find out about Roman Christianity, Eastern Orthodoxy, Islam, and Judaism. And it's just because his capital is in Kiev, so he's right in the middle of Afro-Eurasia. So he has neighbors that follow all of these religions. And then he weighs the pros and cons of those different religions and decides that Eastern Orthodoxy is the best religion for him. His envoys come back and the record is written after the fact, and it's to justify his choice. But when they come back, they say to him that they've seen the Church of Hagia Sophia in Constantinople and in modern Istanbul. And it's so beautiful that he has to choose Eastern Orthodoxy because it's so clearly the church with the greatest power. We can think of Hagia Sophia as a technological marvel, something like maybe a marvelous architectural accomplishment building today that would stun everybody when they saw it, that it was just so advanced.
How common was it for people to make quite pragmatic rather than spiritual decisions about following a particular world religion?
I think it's very common. I think that's probably the norm, that we have many accounts where an individual teacher will preach the teachings of his church. I think it's almost always a he, preachings of his church to a ruler. And so, you know, the rulers are being exposed to church teachings, but the actual decision about which religion to adopt, I think, often boils down to what can the ruler do to enhance his own power?
So it was more often than not based on religious conviction, but more about keeping up with the neighbors, if you like.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. We have many examples of rulers choosing a religion that is associated with a powerful ruler in their neighborhood. And there are extremely few examples of rulers choosing a religion where nobody around them follows that religion.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
So I think that's very important for us, that in the world we're looking at today, to stay as open as we can to other peoples, and also to do our best to learn as much as we can about where they're coming from.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/History Extra.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
You write that as these pathways expanded, it allowed kingdoms and empires to brush up against each other, and goods, people, microbes and ideas all started intermingling. Are there any particular striking examples of this intermingling that we've not already spoken about that you'd like to highlight, I guess?
I think one of the interesting things, and this is also a good example of globalization, is that this, I mentioned the Chinese ceramics that were being produced by the thousands. We also know that they were being shipped in huge quantities because we have some shipwrecks that archaeological excavations of shipwrecks. And so there, and also one of the things about ceramics is that art historians can look at a fired pot from somewhere and know, just by the color of the clay and the color of the glaze, know where it was manufactured. And the there are two pots that were found in an Iranian town called Susa, and one of them is a Chinese export pot, and one of them is a local copy. And that allows us to see that the local copy is nowhere near as high-tech as the Chinese pot. And in a lot of ways, I think the high-fired Chinese ceramics, these are called celadons, and they can be very white, almost translucent, or they can, and they range from that along to a kind of a blue-green. I think they were the iPhones of their day. They were, you could clean them. They were very high-fired, so they were hard, but also the glaze had melted to a glass, so they were very easy to clean. But anyway, we can see in these two pots that the potters in this Chinese world and the potters in the Middle East were competing for market share, and that the Middle East potters didn't have as good a product. They did what they could to emulate the Chinese pots, but they never figured out how to fire them to as high temperatures as the Chinese did. And if you look along the East African coast, you would expect East Africa America to have mostly Islamic pottery as import pottery. There's also some indigenous pottery. But we find a surprising number of Chinese pots there, too, which testify that show that that people really did covet these goods, even though they came from the Chinese pots came from so much farther away than the Middle Eastern pots.
Thank you. Staying with the idea of comparisons between different parts of the world, something that really interests me is the fact that in 1000, the difference between different people in different parts of the world was less great than it was in 1492, when, because the Europeans had invented advanced weaponry, they defeated most other people. How important of a factor was this?
Oh, I think it's a huge factor. One of the most interesting technological, I don't know, competition. So I just told you about one where the Chinese ceramics were of a higher quality than the Middle Eastern ceramics. But there's another technological competition where there's a surprise end. It takes place in Greenland. And we've got the Norse who have settled in southern Greenland. And then they're competing with the Thule is the correct pronunciation of they're not an indigenous people. There are people who are indigenous to Alaska who crossed across North America, the northern edge of North America, so across northern Canada, and then from there settled, moved to Greenland. And I was going to say Thule is spelled Thule, and I think most Americans would say Thule. But anyway, the Thule were competing, and the Thule were able to move all the way across North America because they had figured out a huge technological breakthrough of how to hunt for baby seals year-round. And they dug holes in the ice and then held a feather above the water and just waited until the feather moved. And then that was a sign that there were seals breathing under the water. And they used harpoons that had detachable points so they could throw a harpoon at a seal, or actually a larger animal too, and then the animal would break away. The animal was not yet dead, so it could still swim, and it could swim faster than the people hunting it could follow, but they used a float so that the animal swam away. But since it had been wounded, it would eventually die, and then they could locate it with the float. So they have this technological innovation. And the interesting thing is that the Norse, who are fighting with them in Greenland, don't adopt those technologies. So the upshot is that in 1400, the last Norse pull out from Greenland, and Greenland is occupied entirely by the Thule. And the Thule are the ancestors of today's Inuit peoples. So that's a good example, I think, of people not having these huge technological differences that they do, as you say, have in 1500 because of the invention of the cannon, really. The cannon and the musket, right, are such important, make such a difference to the conflicts between the Europeans and other peoples.
And it was that allowed the Europeans to dominate by the time we get to the 15th century.
Yes.
Yes. How important do you think it is to have a fresh understanding of this period specifically in being a truly global period of world history?
Oh, I think that's one of the great things about history, right? That we are always looking at the past and rethinking our understanding of it. And one of the main changes that's happened in my lifetime is that we just know so much more about other parts of the world outside of Europe. And I think part of what my book is about is archaeological breakthroughs that I know about the export of, we know about the export of chocolate from the Maya to modern New Mexico, to Chaco Canyon, because of chemical analysis of residues in the ceramics. That kind of analysis couldn't have been done 50 years ago. Or we have a sense of how big Angkor Wat was because of a technology called LIDAR that allows for to archaeologists to reconstruct the size of settlements or to identify buildings on the ground that without having to excavate because of by shooting rays at the ground and then reading them as they bounce back. So I think it's incredibly important to, I mean, if to understand how globalization has evolved and to realize that the world has been dealing with this kind of, these kinds of problems for much longer than anybody has previously thought. One of the things that's very striking is that we have anti-globalization riots, and we have them in different parts of the world and early on. So there's one in China, there's a massacre of some expat. I mean, it's a grim topic, killing foreign merchants who've profited at the benefit of local people, but it's a real thing. It's right. It's a problem we face today, too, is the resentment of local people seeing merchants profiting at their expense. But we have the targeting of foreign merchants in China in the late 800s. There's a riot in Cairo in the around the year 1000 against Italian merchants. And then very famously in Istanbul, in Constantinople, is a riot that takes place. It's called the Massacre of the Latins in the 1170s, where the local population turns against the Italian expat merchants. So, you know, I think if we're trying to figure out solutions for our own future, it's very important to understand what's happened in the past, because that's maybe our greatest resource for figuring out how to go forward.
Mm. Do you think this new view of the year 1000 has any lessons for us in 2020?
Well, I think, I mean, when you look at the things that people did and how people reacted, and some people, like we have some accounts of when the Norse first arrived, that they came across a small group of local people, and without even talking to them, they just kill them. But then we have other Norse who encounter local people and try to communicate with them. They have no common language, and try to do some trading with them. There's no question that the people who tried to learn about the other peoples and come reach some accommodation with them do better, prosper, as opposed to those who just have a purely defensive reaction. And so I think that's very important for us, that in the world we're looking at today, to stay as open as we can to other peoples, and also to do our best to learn as much as we can about where they're coming from. I think it'll allow us to negotiate better with them if we have a better sense of their past and how they understand their past.
And as you said about people in 1000, that essentially we're all the same when it comes down to it.
Absolutely, right. Everyone is reacting in very human ways. And that's, I think, one of the things about reading about people in the year 1000 is you can just think, that's such a human way to react to the unknown. So if you cut away all of the non-essentials, the technology and the cell phones and the computers, and just say, how do people react when they encounter other people, then that's what we see happening around the world in the year 1000.
That was Valerie Hansen. Her book, The Year 1000, When Explorers Connected the World and Globalization Began, is on sale now, published by Viking. You can also read more from Valerie in issue 22 of BBC World History's magazine, on sale now. That's available online at buysubscriptions.com. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tune in next on Wednesday, when Dan Jackson will be discussing the history of Northumbria.